Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With today's stock market drop of 630 points, we'll first look at the European markets that tumbled earlier. Former correspondent with Financial Times Germany, Daniela Schwarzer, the head of the European Union Integration Research Division of the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, joins us. She will assess the success of the European Central Bank's intervention and the growing north-south divide inside the Eurozone. Then we'll look into the state of economic literacy in the United States following the debt ceiling debacle and the S&P debt rating agency's repudiation of the deal that has set off financial tremors around the world. Research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, Pavlina Cheneva, joins us to see if any lessons were learned from a brazen act of stupidity that has the nation's self-inflicted financial wound getting worse, as those responsible blame everyone but themselves. Then finally, we will talk with Scott Klinger, the policy director of Wealth for the Common Good, who worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager. He was on the program back in April when he co-authored Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, a report that recently warned the debt crisis being hatched in Congress would lead to unnecessary austerity and cause a double-dip recession. Joining us now is Daniela Schwarzer, who is head of the European Union Integration Research Division at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. She has written widely on European markets and monetary policy. From 1999 to 2004, she was a correspondent for the Financial Times Germany. She is the co-founder and co-editor of European Political Economy Review and the Eurozonewatch.eu website. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniela Schwarzer.
Yes, hello.
There was an expectation that there would be a Black Monday throughout Asia and Europe. There's no question that the markets were down in Europe. The FTSE 100 down 3.40% and the DAX down 5%. That happened in spite of the European Central Bank pledging to push down interest rates on bonds in Spain and Italy. What was your reaction and what's the local reaction, since Germany seems to be the country that stuck with the unenviable role of propping up the euro?
Well, after the development last week, when actually the risk premium on bonds from Italy and Spain went up considerably, the expectations were much worse for this Monday. As you said, Black Monday was expected, and the stock exchanges closed with losses all over Europe, that's obvious, but I think the worst fears were calmed, in particular by the European Central Bank, which intervened in the bond markets today. And that was something new that hadn't happened before, that it started buying bonds of the large economies of Italy and Spain. So far, its bond purchasing program was restricted to the smaller economies such as Greece and Ireland and Portugal. So obviously there is a very clear political will, at least with the president of the European Central Bank, to really take up that role of supporting the bonds of those major countries, because there is a clear fear that things could turn very bad for the Eurozone if actually those two countries would run into refinancing problems.
Well, those two countries, Italy and Spain, of course, are the third and fourth largest economies in Europe. And I understand the fund is only 440 billion euros, which is far too small to rescue Italy. At the end of the day, some analysts are saying that the European Central Bank could end up having to spend about 1.2 trillion. Is that a figure you've heard?
Well, there are figures all over the place. The FT wrote the other week that it was 2.5 even, and other people calculate year by year what has to be put on the market to finance single member states. I've heard numbers up to 1 billion, but we have to really look at the country cases. I mean, if Italy and Spain were the problem, then we would indeed have the third and fourth largest economy. And it is very difficult to imagine how that could be borne by the current rescue mechanisms, because it would mean that on the one hand, Italy and Spain would fall out with their participation in the fund. So that would mean Germany and France would have to bear that load. France could lose its AAA rating. So then it would be Germany as the only AAA rated large country in the Eurozone. So I guess if things turn really bad at the Eurozone, we would indeed have to realize that the current rescue mechanisms and those planned for the year 2013 and onwards will not be sufficient. And I guess the issue of introducing a euro bond would surface in the political debate as a serious option, because the alternative would then really be a default of several countries, including the larger Eurozone countries we were talking about, and that would be a major shock for the financial sector in the Eurozone.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniela Schwarzer, who is head of the European Union Integration Research Division at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. I spoke some time ago with the Nobel laureate Joe Stiglitz. This was actually about a year ago, where he talked about the European disadvantage vis-a-vis the United States, which has the Federal Reserve, and that because the collective nature of the EU means that decisions take longer and reacting to crises, there's a considerable lag. And you have written that in terms of the Greek debt crisis, that the European governments and the IMF and the Eurozone, or the ECB, basically dithered for about a year. Am I quoting you correctly?
Yes, indeed. I mean, for the Greek case, we can see with hindsight that actually waiting with a solution and putting pressure on the country to push reforms actually made markets very nervous. So the price for rescuing Greece went up and up and up. And what we realize now also with hindsight is that the huge rescue mechanism, which was invented last May, the so-called European Rescue Fund, was far too small. And those arguments were out there that it has to be a vast solution, a huge fund, in order to calm markets in a situation where financial markets are very nervous and are sort of bound to leave European bonds if they feel there's a major danger coming up. And you can see that actually the political decision making on the one hand underestimated the potential scope of the crisis, and on the other hand it is far too slow. Just to give you one example, we have the agreement of the special summit of July 21st, where the Eurozone leaders actually agreed to prop up the current fund, to make it more flexible, to allow it to buy bonds in the secondary market. But the problem is they have an agreement, but it has to be ratified by national parliaments. So that gives us a time horizon of roughly September, if they are quick, in order to implement those instruments. And that is far too long to act in a financial crisis.
Is this just the nature of the Eurozone, that there is no rapid response mechanism possible?
Well, there have been rapid responses, but what we realize now is that the only functioning institution on a European level which can act sort of overnight is really the European Central Bank. And if you like, it is taking part of the responsibility which, in my view, lies with the governments of the Eurozone, in that it really acts as a major actor on the bond market in order to stabilize the bonds. And the alternative is indeed in the future the EFSF, but it's not ready to do so yet. We have to go through that new ratification process with all the hurdles you have with national debates. And what we lack is a political entity to face the monetary entity, which is the European Central Bank, which would be able to act in such a way in the currency union. The problem is that you have 70 member states and 17 political responses how to act on that crisis. And that is why negotiation processes do take long. And then, as I said, ratification has to occur. So indeed, I think the Eurozone is facing its limits in terms of rapid crisis management, despite all the success that was there a year ago, or initial success with Greece. But I think we seriously have to ask ourselves the question, not only what kind of rescue mechanisms do we need, but also what kind of political entity with what kind of legitimization from the voters do we need to be able to react in a future crisis, not to allow markets to drive the member states into deep trouble.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniela Schwarzer, who's head of the European Union Integration Research Division at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. She's a former correspondent with the Financial Times Germany, co-founder and co-editor of European Political Economy Review and Eurozonewatch.eu website. So your German Chancellor there, Angela Merkel, has spoken on a number of occasions about her distaste for the idea that the German people, and of course she has a political reasons for being this way, the German people have to bear the brunt as opposed to the banks and bondholders. And I'm wondering, is there a cultural aspect to it? You've talked about the political and economic aspect to the problem. What about a kind of cultural aspect, in the sense that you essentially have the Northern European economies bearing the brunt of the responsibility to bail out the Southern European economies?
It's indeed a problem. For Germany, the whole idea of monetary union was only acceptable because the founding treaty promised, in a way, that it would be a stability union, meaning a central bank which is politically independent and which is there to ensure monetary stability, plus lots of roles and mechanisms to control fiscal policies in order to ensure sound budgets, low deficits, and so on. And now we see after 12 years of European Monetary Union that in particular the surveillance mechanisms for budgetary policies didn't work the way they were expected to. I'm not saying that only the southern European countries breached the rules, also Germany did, and it actually was behind a reform of those rules which gave more scope of action to governments in order to be able to run higher deficits at certain times. But the point is that for the German public, it is very difficult to accept that indeed something went wrong in the Eurozone, while when the euro was introduced, people were promised that this would be a currency which would be as stable as the Deutsche Mark used to be. Now, if you look at the record of the euro, first of all, in terms of internal stability, meaning low inflation, but also external stability, meaning its external value, the euro has performed extremely well. And so far, not even the sovereign debt crisis has caused any trouble in that regard. But now we see that the situation isn't sustainable, that we are running into a situation where the European Central Bank is actually assuming a role where it acts on the bond markets, where it actually puts a lot of money out there, and where we do have to be concerned about the question whether in the future there will be inflationary pressure in the Eurozone. So Germany is very concerned about that whole situation. The people indeed ask themselves, why do we have to pay for the others while we have been, you know, accepting higher taxes, wage cuts, etc., in order to get our house in order. And there is indeed a lot of prejudice out there about southern Europeans, that they've been doing everything wrong. And if you look at the situation in the different southern European member states, you will see that it's not always sort of irresponsible policies which caused the situation, but they're very specific situations. Along, you know, if you look at Greece, it is a particular problem indeed, where you can argue politics sort of ignored the necessity to consolidate, where there was no true implementation of taxation rules, etc. But then again, if you look at Ireland and Spain, they performed economically very well and for a long time were treated as the example cases of a sound economic recovery, but other factors were completely ignored by the European surveillance mechanisms. And now the situation we are in is not only that Europe has to cope with the sovereign debt situation, but also that it has to rethink its complete governance setup, the question how to control national policies, how to anticipate developments which could cause trouble in a single monetary union, and all this is happening in parallel. And indeed, the Germans are trying to get back to the initial idea of creating a stability union, and that is why the German government has been extremely active over the last roughly 18 months in proposing reforms and new rules in order to stabilize the monetary union in the long run.
So clearly, when you talk about the German people paying their taxes, there's a stark contrast with the Greeks, for example, who don't pay taxes. But the other aspect of this, though, that I find so troubling is that all of this money that's pouring out doesn't go to these people in these economies in distress, like the Greek people or the Spanish people or the Portuguese, the Irish, or the Italians, for that matter. They go to the bondholders, and there doesn't seem to be any sanctions in this system where you have irresponsible governments making irresponsible loans like the previous Greek government, and the lenders never get punished, they get rescued. The borrowers who make bad choices get voted out, and the people are left holding the bag.
That is indeed, in my view, one of the major political problems that we will have to cope with in the Eurozone. First of all, it has been a German concern for months now to have a strong degree of private sector involvement in the solution of the sovereign debt crisis. Meaning they wanted to really have the bondholders participate. There have been suggestions on the table to which degree and how this can actually be put into law and so on. But the problem is, if you want to introduce such a mechanism while there's actually a sovereign debt crisis running, obviously the investors leave. So that is precisely what happened. All the discussion on involving the bondholders and sharing the costs made them leave the bonds, and that deteriorated the situation clearly. But the issue is not, you know, off the table, but right now we are in a situation where the European Council has agreed on a voluntary private sector involvement, but what you say is absolutely true. For the time being, the sovereign debt crisis means a transfer of taxpayers' money essentially to the financial industry.
And at the end of the day, Daniela Swartz, do you think that the Eurozone will hold together, that this is sustainable, that this emergency operation, you know, if the patient's bleeding now and they've gone into the emergency room and they've clamped the arteries and stitched up the wound, but I'm belaboring the analogy, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Is the patient going to survive? That's the bottom line.
I can only say today that I hope the patient will survive, and I think we can define certain conditions under which the patient will survive. One is that we considerably move forward with what, you know, is often nicknamed a political union or a kind of European economic government. One element which is key for the current situation is to have a more efficient and more convincing sovereign debt crisis management. That could be, for instance, the introduction of euro bonds, but you could also imagine less spectacular solutions where actually we move to a situation where debt restructuring of even the major economies such as Italy and Spain becomes possible, but only at the cost of transferring a lot of public money into stabilizing financial market institutions. If that's not the case, we will have a major meltdown of the financial sector, and that, you know, that could really break the euro apart. So in my view, first of all, there has to be a very strong political will, not only to find a solution among the 17 member states, but also to be able to communicate this to an increasingly critical public. And secondly, there has to be the will, and quickly, to put more money on the table to find a convincing solution. This is not an easy political situation, I'm totally aware. But if there's some optimism in my words, it is because I think that in particular Germany and France, who are the largest players in this game, who add up to almost half of the GDP of the Eurozone, that they know exactly what the euro has brought to them. As an export economy, Germany is very keen to keep the euro and not to have a Deutschmark back, which, you know, would surely appreciate strongly on the international market and in the European single market. And I think policymakers are increasingly aware of the major risk that is attached to the current situation. So we might see some very blunt solutions, which we couldn't imagine only a few weeks back.
I now remember, Daniela, what my conversation with Joe Stiglitz was some time back. The concern was that it was the Eastern European, the non-Eurozone, with their debt that would be the unraveling of the European economy and causing problems. But it seems now something of a surprise that it wasn't. It was the Western European, the Eurozone. And now, so what does that say about what's happening in the East?
Well, the Central and Eastern European countries were very strongly affected in the first phase of the financial crisis, essentially by the financial sector, which actually had transferred risks from the West to the East by participations in Central and Eastern European banks, etc. Now, as you can see, for instance, from the case of Poland, which is the only country of the whole European Union which didn't at all run into a recession these last few years, there has been a strong economic recovery. For instance, Poland is one of the countries which has a very strong debt brake. That means it has a constitutional rule that the debt-to-GDP ratio shouldn't exceed 60%. So there are actually some countries which pull along economic recovery in the East. Poland is one of them. And that makes us feel rather that we have to revise our initial ideas between Europe being divided economically into East and West, and there's rather a line running through the southern periphery plus Ireland and the rest of Europe. The problem is that the Central and Eastern European countries who recover strongly and grow strongly, they are not part, or at least part of them are not part of the Eurozone yet. And Poland would indeed be a strong add-on to the Eurozone, but we have to see whether politically it remains interesting for Poland to join this kind of currency union.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Daniela Schwarzer.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniela Schwarzer, who's head of the European Union Integration Research Division at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. She has written widely on European markets and monetary policy, and from 1999 to 2004, she was a correspondent with the Financial Times Germany. She is the co-founder and co-editor of European Political Economy Review and Eurozonewatch.eu website. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
After the first and the second world wars, you think us Europeans couldn't take it no more. But we built up and tore down a Berlin Wall, only to build a new and improve the rather crumbling fort. This one was a bit tricky, not visible to the naked eye. And if you was lucky, you could slip through the cracks and the crevices tugging. Your life under your arm, this way some people snuckin', only to become second class citizens. Not listed in the system, not existing in a sense. Legal immigrants, the word left a bit of sense. This place is cold and evil, I should've never went to Port Europa. Don't wanna be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. Hey, can you hear the sound of hysteria? Just stop blaming on America.
Welcome to a new kind of tension. All across the alien nation, where everything is meant to be okay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Pavlina Chinova, who is Professor of Economics at Franklin and Marshall College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as the Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. And since 2007, she has been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. And she is the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, the Macroeconomic Vision. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pavlina Chinova.
Good to be with you.
And given that I'd like to talk with you about the state of economic literacy in the United States following the debt ceiling debacle and the S&P debt rating agency's repudiation of the deal that has set off financial tremors around the globe, with the stock market closing down 630 points today, I wonder if any lessons have been learned from this brazen act of stupidity that has the nation's self-inflicted financial wound getting worse, as those responsible blame everyone but themselves.
Yeah, I think that there are plenty of examples of stupidity and self-inflicted pain, for the last few weeks, from starting the debate on the debt ceiling to this downgrade. There's really just a whole lot of flawed economic ideas that are circulating out there that are driving the political discourse and this really misguided debt rating. The credit rating agencies are supposed to rate on ability to pay, not on willingness to pay. And there's no question in the market's minds and no question in economists' minds that the U.S. government is able to meet its obligations, because all of its obligations are in dollars, and there's just no technical or good economic reasons why the U.S. government cannot meet its obligations in dollars when it has sovereign control over its currency. So what seems to have happened is the S&P has now decided that, you know, the political gridlock may prevent the government from paying, but the political gridlock was resolved. They passed the deal, the debt deal. They raised the ceiling. So it is absolutely unclear what the S&P is trying to do. The markets are not buying it. They are, in fact, moving into Treasury securities. And so it seems to be, you know, perhaps politically motivated.
So does that mean then that the markets are not, as the mainstream press is reporting, and as the Republicans, who, after all, were the ones that manufactured this crisis and essentially held the nation hostage until they got their way, the notion that it's all about the deficit and the need to deal with the debt, and the quote, of course, the mantra that you hear is get our financial house in order. But it looks as if the market's actually responding to what they did, which is taking $2 trillion out of an already weak and sick economy. In other words, instead of priming the pump, they're turning off the tap.
That's right, exactly. So basically, the market understands this. The U.S. federal government can pay its obligations. It's not a matter of default. It's not a matter of the government going bankrupt. We just have to toss this idea out of the window and then focus on the impact of government policies. And the markets are looking at what the government is doing, and they're saying, look, the crisis continues. The American public will probably be held hostage for the next decade, given that we have sort of enshrined into law austerity policies and cuts for the next 10 years. Of course, you know, it remains to be seen what deal will be cut out in October and November, but if we continue with this notion that somehow the U.S. government debt and deficit is public enemy number one that has to be dealt with through cuts and austerity policies, I'm afraid that we are going to be in some trouble in the future. And so if there's one thing that I'd like to sort of, you know, impress upon the public with respect to the government deficit is this very basic, simple idea that there is always a counterpart to the deficit somewhere in the private sector in the form of a surplus. If you look at the data, it bears it out very clearly. A government deficit is always equal to a non-government surplus to the penny. And so then the question is, what will happen to the private sector balances, essentially, when we remove this source of stimulus, when we remove the source of cash flows and incomes that government deficit spending provides? And clearly, they will be reduced. And so there is always a counterpart to the reduction in the deficit. It means that the non-government sector will be accumulating fewer net financial assets.
Well, I understand at this point, Pavlina, before this decision was taken, the austerity decision was taken, my understanding is that $2 out of $10 in circulation come from the government, and that is a huge part of what keeps the economy going, particularly in this recession. And you would think that Economics 101 would make it real clear that what we need to do is restore demand and employment, and all of our problems go away. We wouldn't be having this discussion if we were back to, demand a couple of years ago and employment a couple of years ago.
This is absolutely correct. I mean, it is Economics 101. We know that, government spending is part of GDP, and in the absence of strong consumer demand and investment demand, government spending is our main source of demand, and that has been the case over the last 2 years. Now there is this idea that somehow if the government stops spending, the private sector will magically, boost its confidence and start hiring. And this is really problematic. The private sector hires for one reason only: when they see strong demand coming from somewhere, when there is profit expectations on the horizon, and when our main source of demand dissipates, I'm really not clear why the private sector will actually start hiring and improving the employment situation. So this is absolutely correct. So the focus of the discussion has to be on jobs, employment, on incomes. If you take care of the economy, the debt and the deficits take care of themselves. I think that this myth that we have to deal, put our house, fiscal house in order, is diverting attention from the real problems. I mean, just today, I think State of American Children report came out, and it was really quite distressing. There are 1 in 5 children in poverty, 1 in 6 people on food stamps. We have the highest child poverty rate of all developed nations by quite a large margin. And so we've got some very specific and real problems to address, and yet policy seems to be slashing the very programs that are assisting the poor, the low-income groups, the middle-income class, children, and on and on. So it's politics completely upside down.
Again, I'm speaking with Pavlina Chernova, who is an economics professor at Franklin and Marshall College and a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. Well, Pavlina, there was just a poll out a couple of days ago that made it clear that 82% of the American people agree with what you said before we talked about the children aspect, and you've prompted me to realize that we've got to do a program on this tomorrow, on this terrible statistics that you just read and this report that's just come out. But just back to the idea that the real economic discussion should be about jobs and not deficits. 82% of the American people agree with that. So can you explain to me and our audience what the president was thinking? Why did he do what he did? Because what he did is going to hurt him and the Democrats get reelected.
Well, I think that he is betting the opposite. I think that he is trying to play the middle, and he thinks that that will win him the election. He may be right. The problem is that the middle keeps shifting to the right, and he has not participated in any meaningful way in redefining what the middle means or what the center means. Just he keeps moving to the right and keeps really offering the kind of sacrifices that I wouldn't expect from a Democratic president. In the debates, he offered $650 billion cuts in Social Security. I mean, this is something to ponder for years to come. Luckily that, Boehner walked out, and then what will happen to Social Security remains to be seen. hopefully the Democrats will stand by this program. But I think that the electorate is smarter than this. They are very disillusioned with, there's a good chunk of the electorate that is disillusioned with Obama's policies, and they were hoping that he will be bolder and more progressive. And I don't see really a progressive agenda in Obama's policymaking. If anything, I see quite a conservative agenda. So at the end of the day, the impact of these austerities, I mean, that will not be felt right away. You know, the cuts are very small for next year. However, the stimulus that was passed in 2009 is already expiring. The funds have been almost completely disbursed. And so we're going to be in for some, you know, very serious times and, you know, sluggish, stagnant growth and really no improvements in the, you know, meaningful improvements in the jobs picture. I think people will have very little tolerance for this. But the other problem, I think, in the, sort of in the conventional understanding of the government stimulus was that it didn't really work. And that's why, in part, a portion of the electorate has stood behind some of these austerity policies. And we just need a very good education on what the stimulus did and what it didn't do. I'm quite surprised that, you know, the Obama administration hasn't been out there and saying, look, you know, we have funded the following kinds of activities on the state level, public investments, infrastructure, education. These are the kinds of jobs that we have created. These are the number of jobs. I mean, this has to be the message of the Obama administration. Unfortunately, if you look at the stimulus numbers, it shows that the stimulus worked, but it didn't create nearly enough. In the current employment situation, where we have 20 million people that are unemployed or underemployed, the stimulus created somewhere between 1.5 and 3.5 million jobs. I mean, that just can't do it. You know, it won't cut it. And so we just have to do more of that. And, you know, people can go on the government website and look at the specific projects that the government has funded from the overall stimulus package of $800 billion that they passed. You know, some of it went to tax cuts and some of it went to unemployment insurance and entitlements, but about $275 went to actual direct job creation. And you see a series of, you know, research projects, R&D, medical research, police departments that received money, educational institutions, housing projects, on and on and on and on. These are very tangible things. The Obama administration has got to bring them out to the fore and say, look, this is how many jobs we created. We just have to do more of the same.
Well, the thing that worries me, Pavlina Chernova, is that in the absence of defending Social Security and the president apparently put it on the table in these negotiations, and everybody knows, or everybody should know, and of course we are dealing with economic illiteracy here, but the Social Security pays for itself. It's not a problem. Medicare is not a problem. Except the private part of medicine, the healthcare industry, it's the private sector, which is the right. Vast bulk of it. That's out of control. That's why he tried to come forth with this healthcare reform, albeit, you know, a racehorse designed, by a committee ends up being a camel. But the long and the short of it is this: Romney, he's found an opening here. He's saying that S&P's decision to downgrade the U.S. debt was due largely to promises the federal government has made to entitlement programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. A nation just can't pay this much back. This is absolute monstrous lying stupidity, but it's out there on the political stump. He's the Republican front runner. And unless Obama starts shooting this nonsense down, the public's going to buy it.
Exactly. Well, okay, actually, on the Social Security, I have my suspicions, because Social Security was declared broke the first year it was passed. It has been the history of the Social Security program that there was always some policymaker that wanted to destroy this vital safety net. But it is one of those safety net that across the board, Republican or Democrat people want to defend. They are not so ready and willing to sacrifice it. So I have my skepticism. I think that people will vote against anyone who wants to dismantle Social Security, Medicare, and I think the latest, the recent election in the New York State in a very Republican district where a Democrat won is very telling. People want to preserve Social Security and Medicare. So I think, and I hope, I really hope that this is a big gamble on Romney. Yes, there are important issues to address with respect to Medicare and private costs, private drug costs, etc. Social Security is a sound program. And speaking of poverty, it is the primary reason why we have seen a precipitous decline in elderly poverty in the United States. This is the only group that is not seeing an uptick in their poverty rates. You know, all the other groups are seeing a rise in poverty in their latest recession, except for the elderly.
And you just pointed out that this new report on poverty in children, which is, alarming.
Exactly. And so there is, if you dismantle Social Security, if then you dismantle one of the most important income support programs for the retired. So I certainly hope that the voters will not let this happen. But anything is possible. In this environment, I've been surprised many times.
But the idea that this is the reason why the S&P downgraded the U.S. debt rating is because of Social Security costs. I mean, somebody should get out there and refute that nonsense. That's what I find. Obviously, the campaign is going to start much later. It's bad enough that they take 2 or 3 years of our time running for president. A year is enough, and presumably at some point or other, the president's going to start running. But in the meantime, the progressives are thinking about running a challenger in the primary, and people are talking about a third party and all this stuff. So I just don't understand the reason we began this discussion is trying to find out who's the advocate for economic literacy out there. Who's the giving us these teachable moments that we need so that we don't allow these stupid decisions to be made that unnecessarily impoverish millions of Americans?
The argumentation that it is entitlements that are really the problem is really just an ideological stance, pure and simple. The financial markets have wanted to get their hands on Social Security for many, many decades. It represents a huge source of profits, but we know what happens when you privatize such safety nets. And so we just have to make sure that we preserve these programs. But with respect to the propagation of false ideas, I'm afraid that my own profession has played a significant role as well. Some of these ideas can be found in the textbooks, and my profession is really due for a renaissance. We have failed to predict, not all of us, but en masse, the economic profession failed to predict the most serious crisis in the post-war era. It has failed to deliver meaningful proposals for recovery. We have still this sort of trickle-down model of economic recovery that is failing again and again. And so I think that, we have to look very carefully at the economic textbooks and the models to start generating some more sensible ideas about what governments can and cannot do. Unless we have these, good models, the public is going to be misled by policymakers and their interests, I'm afraid.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Pavlina Cheneva.
Good talking to you.
Good talking to you, too. I've just been speaking then with Pavlina Cheneva, who is Professor of Economics at Franklin & Marshall College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. And since 2007, she's been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. And she's the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, The Macroeconomic Vision. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be joined by Scott Klinger, the author, co-author of Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, that back in April we spoke with him, and he predicted that this very disaster would come to pass.
They said I better take anything they go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Klinger, who is an Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the Policy Director for Wealth for the Common Good. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. Back in April, he was one of the authors of a report called Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thank you, Ian.
And I went into the archives because to listen to our last discussion back in April, Scott, you that report that you came out with then, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, really recently warned that the debt crisis being hatched in Congress would lead to unnecessary austerity and to a double dip recession. And how did it happen? Why didn't somebody stop this? I guess in a way, the question would, why did the president allow it to happen? Or couldn't he stop it? Because him and the Democrats are going to suffer. It looks as if the markets are saying they're not. This S&P thing, I think, has got people distracted. I think the real issue here is the markets are saying you've taken $2 trillion out of already a sick economy. It's going to, we're heading for a double dip recession.
Yes, it is a distraction. And it's interesting to note that while the stock market was down staggeringly today, that the bond market was, I think, closed up even a little bit. So you would think if the debt was really in trouble that the bond market would have been just as panicked or more panicked than the stock market. So this is sadly a part of a continuing story of manufactured crises to cut benefits for middle and working class Americans. It started really 20 years ago, and it's accelerated through the recession of 2 years ago, and now today. It's just been one crisis after the next, and it's sad. It's sad to have published a report that has come so close to predicting the future in a bad way.
So is this Naomi Klein's shock doctrine? Is this what's in play here, where crises become the opportunity for these mendacious forces who want to get their way?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had been thinking about her book as a frame for this over the last couple of weeks, and I think that's the right analogy. We think all the way back to when President Obama came into office and we had the failure of Lehman Brothers and the world was going to collapse if we didn't bail out the big banks with trillions of dollars of bailouts. And, and then it continued to a lesser extent last December when unemployment benefits were about to run out, and they were held hostage to extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, and then once again we had this debt crisis that escalated the disaster scenario that if we didn't extend the debt ceiling that the U.S. would default and the world would end as we know it. So it's sad that we keep falling for the same familiar drama.
And of course, the old adage is that the Chinese character for crisis and opportunity is one and the same. But in this case...
But our response to the crisis is cutting off our opportunity because...
But it becomes opportunity for those... It becomes an opportunity for those who provoke the crisis.
Yeah.
And it becomes a loss for everybody else.
Yeah, loss of our opportunity, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still reeling in shock from... We just had a conversation about economic literacy, which is desperately needed. What do you think is going to be the teachable moment, Scott Klinger?
Well, I think this is starting to be a wake-up call for people. And, you said earlier you reflected on why didn't someone like the president or Congress stop it. I don't think it's going to be the president or Congress that stop it. I think it's going to be the people that stop it. And, we see what's happening in other countries with people showing up in the streets in large number and saying enough. We see what's happening in Wisconsin of, protesting and then having recall elections. That story needs to get written on a larger canvas for the whole country.
It may be written on a... the only people who are going to write on a large canvas are the people. The mainstream press are the ones that keep putting out all of this nonsense about we have to get our fiscal house in order. They are completely echoing the Republican line. And I'm talking about all across the media spectrum.
Absolutely. And the S&P Standard & Poor's in being the debt rating agency that cut the U.S. debt rating has really played a funny role in this, because they shifted from being the chief cheerleader for speculative investment over the last decade, missing the problems with Enron and others, and certainly missing the huge problems with the subprime lending crisis that drove Lehman out of business and sent the banking industry into a death spiral. And now they've turned into the austerity police, much like a role that the IMF would play in developing countries in terms of, you know, demanding greater cuts. And it's like Wall Street is holding Main Street hostage. Wall Street's saying, we won't give you any capital unless you play by our rules and cut the benefits that go to small business and middle class and working class people.
So where is the political organization? I mean, one of the things that I find extraordinary, Scott Klinger, again, co-author of the report back in April, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, where is the I'm so mystified as to how it is that a small group of right-wing zealots on the Republican Party, called the Tea Party, but it's essentially that's just an astroturf repackaging of the right wing of the Republican Party, albeit a clever, because everybody uses that term, Tea Party, but essentially a small group of far-right Republicans drove the Republican Party to the right, captured the national agenda, and extorted the entire economy into this near-death experience from which they have benefited and been rewarded. So if where's the countervailing energy on the left?
Well, I think it's the fact that the rules have been shifted, right? And it's not just that there's a small number of people. It's a small number of people with a huge number of dollars. And those dollars have gone into not only campaign contributions, political investments in Washington, D.C., in both parties, but also in terms of buying the media, buying the storytellers. And, you know, we really need some different means of telling stories. We need ways of deepening our political knowledge and political literacy, as you said earlier, with some different stories that we tell one another, whether it's through community groups or church groups or labor groups. You know, we have to get back into a story that doesn't end with whatever's best for the corporations is good for me, because that's the story we've been told, and it hasn't worked out very well.
Well, we have a perfect front man for corporations running on the Republican ticket, and he just blamed the S&P downgrade of the United States' creditworthiness on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. I'm talking about Mitt Romney.
Right. You know, and it's just...
I mean,
it's shameful.
Is anybody behind... I mean, I guess I asked my previous guest, I said, well, you know, surely somebody should challenge this nonsense, but because I guess... It's too early.
There's an interesting footnote to that kind of connects the dots to what I was just saying, is there's a corporation that was formed, I believe, late spring in Massachusetts, and it was incorporated anonymously, which is legal in the United States. There's a million corporations in the United States who you cannot find out their owner because they're anonymous. This corporation made $1 million contribution to Mitt Romney's campaign, which they could under the New Citizens United Supreme Court case, and then promptly disbanded. So it is no more. So this is exactly how the money is finding its way into politics, untraceable, unaccountable, and that's why the votes go against us. It's not enough to email your senator or representative or even pick up the phone and call anymore. That message isn't being recorded when the checks come in from $1,000 donors or more, or in this case, $1 million donor.
My understanding is that I understand this dichotomy that between the power of money and the power of votes, and that the fulcrum, the center, has moved to the point where money has more power than votes. But that's only because people don't vote. And already after this debt ceiling sellout, the progressives are now talking about running a third party challenger in the primaries, which of course will end up with the same results that happened with Jimmy Carter, where Ted Kennedy damaged him, and then in the general, the progressives then voted for Anderson and helped elect Reagan. So we have that history of third parties where with Nader in 2000 in Florida, and before that, Ross Perot. The Republicans still blame Ross Perot for electing Bill Clinton. So I don't know that there's anything to be gained from that route. But what about just millions and millions of people? That's what you think is going to change it. Millions of people are just going to have to start showing up.
Yeah, well, look what happened. We had this huge fight over the debt ceiling. We're cutting, you know, $1 trillion out of social programs primarily, and cutting deep into things that the vast majority of Americans have counted on and relied on. We've put Social Security and Medicare on the table, and we didn't cut one corporate tax break, not even a silly corporate jet deduction, you know, which should be a no-brainer, an easy one, the oil subsidies, the ethanol subsidies, nothing, not a penny. So it's all on the people, and unless the people stand up and say, no, that's not the way it's going to be. We need different rules. This isn't laws of nature, laws of God that have caused this to happen. These are rules that we've allowed to be tipped badly against us and in favor of the very few at the top.
So do you think there's anything that could be done culturally? I mean, you know, I'm speaking to you from Hollywood, right across the street from Universal Studios. And during the Great Depression, of course, they made films about silly heiresses in big estates, Philadelphia Story and all that kind of stuff. And not that was a good movie, but I'm saying there was this vicarious indulgence of wealthy characters, and you know, so much of television is about who wants to be a millionaire, and it's all about it's all very mercenary. Is there a possibility that we could have a countervailing kind of cultural shift in this country to shame these, you know, these idle rich, you know, as Bill Gates' father said, you can't sail two yachts at the same time.
Right. You can't. And I was thinking about that today. I was in a bookstore and picked up a book about how Uncle Tom's Cabin changed the world back in the 1800s and how it really catalyzed the abolitionists, and it had reached far beyond America's shores. So I think the arts is a place that can inspire a different story. All this is about the stories we hold. And right. As long as we're going to hold a story that my ship is tied to the fortunes of
a billionaire, Google, right. That's exactly the way that the working people have been told, that your fortune is tied to a billionaire's tax breaks. I thank you for joining us, Scott Klinger.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, Scott Klinger, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's a chartered financial analyst, previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. And back in April, he was a co-author of the very prescient report, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with, of course, the crash of the stock exchange today, down 630 points, but it was preceded by the European markets, which tumbled. So we talked with a former correspondent with the Financial Times in Germany, Daniela Schwarzer, who basically, Germany is the one that's propping up the euro, and they're taking the major hit. And it was very interesting. She basically said that she thought that the European Central Bank maybe have staunched the immediate bleeding, but they haven't solved the problem. And that the problem is, curiously enough, a north-south problem, a divide between Southern Europe and Northern Europe, where the people in the north pay their taxes, the people in the south don't, at least the Greeks being a prime example. It's not the disease in Europe, which Joe Stiglitz and others that I mentioned predicted some time ago, that it'd be the Eastern European weakness and the borrowing in euros in the non-eurozone would create a default cascading through to the West. But in fact, the cascading is coming from the south up to the north. And I asked her about what kind of mechanisms can the Germans or the Europeans develop, because they're not like the United States, which has a Federal Reserve. They're a bunch of sovereign nations pooling their economy into one currency, and they don't seem to have any kind of rapid response mechanism. And she felt that they could develop, and I mean, she was extremely technocratic and very, very bright woman. I can't pretend to know all the details of what she said or understand them all, except to say that she thinks that they will staunch the bleeding. But then I asked her, well, will the patient survive? She said, well, that remains to be seen. Then we talked about the state of economic literacy in the United States following this debt ceiling debacle and the downgrading of the U.S. Debt by this S&P crowd, which has caused all this panic around the world. Pavlina Cheneva, a very bright woman, had some interesting stuff to say about the lack of financial literacy, how the mainstream press and the Republicans, and to some extent the White House, have been echoing so many economically illiterate notions. But curious enough, the public seemed to know. 82% of the public thought that what we should be talking about is jobs, not the deficit. And of course, we all know Economics 101, that if you're having a recession, you prime the pump, you don't turn off the tap and have the economy die, which is pretty much what they're doing, what this ridiculous austerity vote the other day guarantees. At the end of the day, though, she, you know, with Mitt Romney saying that the S&P downgrade of America's debt was entirely to do with Social Security, we simply just can't, it's not sustainable. And she basically said they've been saying that since the beginning of Social Security. And all that's about is Wall Street wants to get its hands on all that money. And Mitt Romney, of course, being a Wall Streeter, no, surprise, surprise. Finally, we spoke with Scott Klinger, who I spoke with back in April. He predicted all of this in a study he did called Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. And he basically said that the people of this country have got to rise up, that there's just no question the political class have failed us. They're bought by the powerful interests, and that the only way to turn America around is for the people not to form a third party, not to run a primary challenge, but to get out on the streets en masse. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.